This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. If you're in the workplace, are you among more than a third of workers who've been bullied? 37% of people say they've been bullied in the workplace, according to research released today by the law firm Slater and Gordon. It also saw a further one in five say they've seen others being bullied. That's interesting. Have you ever seen someone else being bullied and decided to take action? Or do you just think, I'm not going to get in the way of that? That looks too ugly. I don't want any of that. The majority say they were bullied by a colleague. Almost half say they face bullying from their boss or management. 70% saying it goes on over a sustained period of time. It's defined as rudeness, intimidation, shouting, humiliating behaviour, and gossiping. Gossiping is now bullying? Christine Pratt is founder of the National Bullying Helpline and an employment law expert and joins me now. Good morning to you. How is
Good morning, Nick.
Good morning. How is gossiping bullying?
Well, it's not just gossiping, is it? It's more really to do with the culture that we're living in today. And I think uniquely by running a bullying helpline for employees and running an HR consultancy and advising employers, I am fortunate in that I am seeing both sides of the coin here. I'm hearing from both, you know, both sides here.
And so what sort of stories are you hearing? May I call you Christine? Is that all right?
Yes, of course.
Christine,
yes.
What sort of stories, instances are coming your way?
Well, I think largely we're hearing about line manager relationships with employees and conflict there or lack of skills. We're hearing about mobbing and collusion.
Mobbing?
Amongst staff. Mobbing and collusion, yes. And often that is where there is not a strong leader in place.
Right.
I think we need to remember we're living in a society now. We've created a culture where employees are far more aware of their employment rights. It's the culture that we have created, from equality and disability to grievances and appeals and flexible working relationships. The employee now knows their rights. We have the tail wagging the dog, if you like, because the employee is banging the table. And where there is a weak manager in place, and it only takes a manager who perhaps would prefer to focus on the business.
Yeah.
Who perhaps...
Well, that's their job, of course.
...the training they need. And
Christine,
you get a lack of respect.
Christine, that's their...
relationship.
Right. The reason they've been made a manager is so they do focus on the business and they drive it forward.
I don't agree. I think that is the ideal world that we...
Define the role of a manager, then.
Well, it's not about defining the role of the manager.
Well,
the
respectfully, I've just said a manager is put on earth to drive the business forward. Obviously, observing all legalities, of course. But he or she is in place. Because I have you run large organisations, Christine?
No, but I have managed teams.
Sure, okay.
And I am hearing daily from staff from the NHS,
right,
for example.
So when I was running... Can you imagine this, madam? When I was running the newsroom at the Sun newspaper, which was quite a task, as you can imagine, I was put there to make sure that the reporters got the best possible stories we could, that we turned out what we thought was the best possible newspaper, because then we sold as many... I'm not there to sit there wondering, well, I wonder how my crime reporter's feeling today. I'm there to make sure he gets the best story out of Scotland Yard. Do you understand?
I understand.
Aha!
I'm hearing about it daily. I'm hearing about...
But that's what I'm doing right, aren't I, as the manager?
No.
I see. So now what will I say to Rupert Murdoch when the Sun gets beaten day in, day out by the Daily Mirror?
A line manager needs to be able to identify business risk and manage staff. Think about the NHS. Most...
I'm not worried. At the moment, I'm not worried. I'm running a newspaper, and the NHS I'll come to in a minute, right? And now, because I've got to make sure my reporters are comfortable, we are missing stories every single day.
Then you should be appointed and assigned to focus on that and not manage teams. A team leader, a manager of people, should have necessary skills to do that.
But
otherwise, you're going to get conflict, fallout, grievances, disciplinaries.
Right. A newspaper is a fairly vibrant place, as you might be aware. It can be fairly a combative atmosphere in which one works, because it's so brutally competitive. You are literally as good as that day's paper.
Yeah.
So I can't be sitting there wondering whether my health reporter's having troubles at home. I've just got to make sure the stories are coming out. Please, come to the real world, Christine.
I think I am living in the real world. I understand what you're saying. You want to focus on the business. Those medics want to focus on medicine. It's about appointing the managers and leaders with the skills to lead and manage.
Let's try
as well as run the business.
Are you as well as drive the business forward? Well, we definitely need people like you because you're there for these folk who have troubles. Could you do? Would you indulge in a little bit of role play for a moment?
Okay.
Thank you. I just made you the editor of a newspaper, and I'm the proprietor, right?
Yes.
Christine, every day last week, every day, the other newspaper, you're editing The Sun. The Daily Mirror sold more copies, had better stories, and was on all the newses. Your newspaper had nothing. I'm sick of it. Put it right this week or get out.
Well, you make sure that when you recruit the right skills.
You tell me, you're in charge of that. I give you the money to hire the reporters, the news editors, the photographers. You do it all, Christine, and we are losing every single day. What are you going to do about it?
Look at the skills that I have. Look at the resources that I have. Look at where the gaps are. Look at whether we're spending more money on absenteeism and performance management and things.
But why
like
don't you tell me that in advance? Why aren't you ringing me at the beginning of last week saying I've got skills gaps, I've got absenteeism? All I'm seeing is the sales figures, and I'm falling off a cliff, and the rivals have taken off like a rocket.
The HR functions that have responsibility largely for these areas of the business. If you've got problems with staff and conflict in teams.
Of course you've got conflict. That's what teams are about. You want a bit of healthy conflict. That's what works. You want some healthy creativity.
Healthy conflict, yeah, but not when it hits the bottom line and when it affects performance and productivity and the pounds and pennies that are coming in. When it starts to disrupt the business and affect an impact on the business and cause risk in terms of litigation and high absence and sickness and all these issues that create a damaging and a culture that is not an employer of choice. That is when you need to revisit your skills, look at your leaders and make sure you've got your ducks in a row and your processes in place.
Can a boss...
Very often, line managers and heads of department know where the policies are but haven't read them.
Can a boss ever shout at an employee?
Pardon?
Can a boss ever shout, or can a workmate ever shout at a colleague?
Not at a colleague, no.
Why?
No, I believe that would be inappropriate. It would undermine them. It would be demeaning. It would create a culture of imitation and fear. And
what are you meant to do? If someone has spectacularly failed to do something for you since 6:45 in the morning and now it's 8:43, what are you... And you've asked four or five times and nothing's been done. What am I meant to do?
Take them to one side.
I can't. I'm on the radio. How can I take them to one side?
Well,
I get split seconds to shout at them during the news.
Manage them. You shouldn't be their line manager if you don't have the time to give them.
What do you mean got the time? I've got a minute and a half of news and then we're back on air and he's not done it. I've only got a minute to give him a damn good spray to make sure it's done next time.
How many people do you manage?
Well, I don't actually. I'm not a line manager anymore, but there's a team that works to this show of about four.
Your skills are broadcasting, and that is where you've been placed, and quite rightly so.
Great speaking with you. Thank goodness for people like Christine Pratt, who's founder of the National Bullying Helpline and an employment law expert. John's in Lewisham. You're on the radio, John.
Nick, I think definitely I see your point of view in your environment.
Yeah.
But I think you're missing the point that not all environments are like your experience.
No, I agree.
So I personally think gossiping can be used as a form of bullying.
Oh, please, John, toughen up, man.
Hear me out. You've got some companies whereby not the line manager makes the decision on whether people get pay raises, etc. But it's the directors. If my line manager is gossiping about me to the directors, of course she's painting a bad picture for me.
Yeah.
So now when it comes for me... I will do that.
Are you man or mouse, John?
No, I'm a man.
I want you to roar, I'm a man.
I'm a man.
There you go. So just rise above it. Just laugh at them. And I tell you what...
My wallet is still hurting.
Yeah, I hear your wallet, brother. But now gossip with your workmates about how terrible your boss is. Turn it back on them.
Exactly.
And here's something that bosses can't handle. I've learnt this. When you see them, you just point and laugh. You don't explain why. You just see your boss and you just point and go... and then keep walking. They don't know what to do. First time they smile at you because they think... When you've done it for a good 6 weeks, they go, why does he keep pointing and laughing at me?
I'm going to try that today.
Good luck, buddy. What are you in? What business are you in?
I'm a project manager, mate.
Call me tomorrow and see how it goes down in Lewisham when John sees his boss and simply goes...
point and laugh. It's the way forward.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC.
Laura Wade-Gerry, Executive Director of M&S, tipped to be the company's next chief executive, indeed the first one in its more than 100-year history. Why is this such a talking matter? Well, A and 1, you had to do a stock market announcement that you're going to have a baby. B and 2, she's so high profile. C and 4, just checking. C and 3, Mrs. Wade-Gerry is 50. She'll begin her maternity leave at the start of next month and says she'll be back at her desk by early January. No other details are given about the birth, which is due in September, although it is her first child. She's married to Simon Roberts, a farmer, and divides her life between a London flat and a farm in Suffolk, the Times informs us. The Times also says she's part of a growing trend of older mums who delay having children to build their careers. The number of women aged over 40 having had a baby has risen fourfold in the past 30 years. And now, mums over 40 account for 1 in 25 births, or you could almost say 4%. The trend, though, is controversial. Dame Sally Davis, the nation's chief medical officer, says there's a steady shift towards women postponing a family until their late 30s and early 40s. It reduces their chance of conception and increases medical risks. She's expressed concern. What's it like, then, bringing up a baby if you're 50? Well, having the baby, I'm so sorry, if you're 50. I always use sort of various milestones, if you will. As and when he or she toddles through the primary school gates, mum is going to be 54, 55, depending on when the child is and her birthday, blah, 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 blah. When they go to big school, mum's going to be 61 or 62. And other mums with whom her little child will run and mix with, highly likely you're going to have girls in their late 20s, early 30s, certainly in their 30s. Effectively, sort of granddaughter's age to this mum. Now, look, no one can say when you know you're going to meet the right fella and when it feels right and when you're going to have babies and da-da-da. It's obviously up to the individual, but it's a bit old, isn't it? Carrie Rosen wrote The Secret Diary of a New Mum, age 43 and a quarter, and edits grandsnet.com, joins me now. Is 52 old? Good morning.
Good morning, and I think so, yes.
Why?
I speak as someone who... Well, first of all, it was interesting what you were saying, postponing motherhood. When I wrote the book, I did a huge amount of research and interviewed over 100 women who had babies in their 40s, and the vast, vast majority, well over 95%, had not done it because of their career. It's all about meeting the right person to have a child with. And I do think that the media often misrepresents this. You know, if you're postponing it to have a career, then yes, be aware of the risks and think about it. But if you haven't met someone you want to have a child with, what are you going to do about it? You have to take your chances. And most of the women I spoke to were only too aware of the risks of waiting and that it might not happen. And for some, it didn't. But... anyway, 52-year-old, I have a 7-year-old. I had when I was 43 and a quarter, as you know. I'm now 50. Would I even consider having another child? No.
Why?
Did I consider having a second child?
But supposing you hadn't had your... supposing you hadn't met your partner, your husband, whatever it might be, and you only met him today, are you saying you wouldn't do what Ms. Wade-Gerry is doing?
It's interesting. We've actually had this discussion very recently, and I don't think that I would have done.
Wow!
I really wanted a second child, but I felt that 45, 46 was probably too old. Would I have tried for first at 45? Probably. But 50...
What is it? No. Okay, you're a lady, you're a woman. What trips in a female psyche that, I've met this man, I love this man, he's the guy I've been looking for all of my adult life, I'm going to have a baby at 45. Whoa, 50, no, too old. What's tripped over? What's gone wrong? Wrong's the wrong word. What's happened?
I mean, I physically and mentally feel the shift between sort of early to mid-40s and 50, for sure.
Is it not just a number?
They say it's just a number, but having celebrated my birthday this year, it was quite a big number to come to terms with when I still think you're 35 inside. Mm. But, yeah, no, my life hasn't changed at all since I turned 50. However, you know, the average age of menopause in this country is 51, which means that half women are younger than 51, so... the menopause is absolutely nature's way of telling you enough is enough.
Interesting way of putting it.
Yeah. It's not uncommon. It's never been uncommon to have babies in your 40s, except in Victorian times it would have been your 10th and not your 1st. Mm. And it's not uncommon to have them in your early 40s. And there's nothing, whatever the male or whoever wants to say about it, unnatural about it either. You know, and of course some people do get pregnant in their late 40s, 50s, quite naturally and whatever. And I'm certainly not condemning anyone who has fertility treatment at any age. However, you do have to think about, you know, your age, your physical well-being.
And presumably your age as and when we hit certain milestones, i.e. the kiddie goes to primary school for the first day.
Yeah. I mean, my daughter's at a North London primary school where when she started, over a third of the mothers in the class were over 40. It's not abnormal where we live. In other parts of the country, it would be really weird that I was 40-something with a child starting reception. You know, it does vary enormously. And I'm sure that, you know, in the city, there are women who have consciously made that decision, and in other careers, obviously, consciously made that decision to delay for their career, even though it's not as prevalent as people like to make you think. And, you know, and so it's probably not abnormal in those circles. However, there's something, when I was researching the book, called Cambridge Syndrome, a gynecologist was telling me about, which is high-flying women who've done brilliantly at school, brilliantly at university, brilliantly at their careers.
Yep.
They've had everything they wanted along the way, and they think the baby's the next thing, and then they often find that they can't. And that does, you know, I don't think anyone should enter into it naively. And by delaying motherhood, I think you should be very aware of the risks that you might not have a child at all.
Carrie Rosen, author of The Secret Diary of a New Mum, aged 43 and a quarter, editor also of GrandsNet.com. Thank you. Listening, Jenny Garrett, executive career coach, also author Rocking Your Role. It's a guide for women who earn, or are the main salary earners in the family. First question, same first question to you then, is 50 too old? Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I don't think 50 is too old. I think 50 probably is the new 30. And I know that when I was growing up, 50 really was old and people looked old. And now they're fit and healthy at 50. And I think we have to review those numbers, actually.
What about the kiddie? What about the child? Gets picked up at the school gates. Let's say they're doing their GCSEs or whatever they'll be called in 15 years, 16 years' time. And mum is approaching 70.
Yeah, I think things are shifting, and a 70-year-old woman doesn't look like a 70-year-old woman used to look, or man, but, you know.
But she is a 70-year-old woman. I mean, the body obviously is not going to be as fit as she was when she was in her 20s and 30s. That's a fact of life.
Yeah, it is a fact of life, but I think there are swathes of parenthood. You know, when I had my daughter, I had her when I was 30, there were the very young mums. I was sort of in the middle group, and then there were some older mums. And I think there are groups of mums. I think comparing ourselves, actually, is a waste of time, and I don't think we should be worrying about Laura Wade Jerry, should be worrying about the 20-year-old mums who are going to be at the playground. She is who she is, and as long as she's a very good parent and there for her child and gives her child love. I think those are things that are really important.
But lastly, when the child is asked, why does your gran come and get you from school, how is he or she going to respond to that?
Yeah, in the same way that you might do when someone says, why does your sister get you from school? And you have to say, it's my mum. You know, I had a very young mum. My mum was 17 when she had me. And, you know, I had those very young mum questions. You deal with them.
Thanks for that. Jenny Garrett, executive career coach, author of Rocking Your Role. June's in Orpington. How old were you? Sorry, how old was mum when she had you? Good morning.
It was my husband's mum.
Who had you? That's a heck of a story.
My husband. No, we're not that much of a crazy family.
It's not Norfolk, is it? Sorry, go on.
He has three elder siblings who were one section of the family. Then when they were already adults, she had another three children. He's the youngest of those three.
By the same dad? These are all by the same mum and dad?
Oh, yeah, same mum and dad.
So may I ask your husband's age?
My husband is now 58.
And he's the youngest of the whole troop?
He's the youngest of the whole troop,
and
yes.
We go up to... I trust the oldest is still
84.
With us. His brothers and sisters, the age range is 58 through 84?
Correct.
How old was his mum when... Let's get this right. How old was his mum when she had him? I'm there now.
49.
This would have been in the mid-50s. Would have been like mid-50s, presumably.
Yeah.
That was almost unheard of, wasn't it?
His two oldest sisters and his mum were all pregnant at the same time, three times, with himself, his next sister up, and the next sister up from that.
Didn't they have television?
the thing is, because his mum was so elderly, and his, and back so, then that age was elderly, and his 40. Dad was quite a bit older than his mum. By the time he was 7, he lost his dad. Oh. By the time he was 14, he lost his mum.
Oh, Lord.
My husband has never been able to share with his parents...
the joy.
...him finding his partner, myself.
Yeah.
His, the birth of his children, their grandchildren through him.
Yeah.
Him achieving head chef status when he went into the workplace.
Yeah.
Him, the milestones he's reached in his life, the little things that you... when you do something and you think... I want to tell my mum. He has never had that in adulthood, ever. And when I moan and complain about my mum being demanding at age 87, I feel guilty because I know he would give anything to have a demanding parent who was older.
Look, I realise I was incredible. I only lost mum last year and I'm in my 50s. But even now, you still want to tell her things. I still, something happens and I still think, oh, God, I'll tell mum. Well, I will one day, but not by conventional methods.
Yeah.
Very, very tough. Very, very tough.
And my son was denied having two sets of grandparents. He's only ever had the one set of grandparents.
Yeah, I mean, I hear you. Denied is a strong word here, June.
Denied.
I mean,
they made the conscious choice to have a child.
But hang on.
Can
I have your husband's first name?
Selfish.
Can I have your husband?
Trevor.
You wouldn't have Trevor if they hadn't done it, love.
No, he's very, very grateful that he was born, but he thinks that their actions... The next child up from him has Down syndrome. He thinks their actions in continuing to have another child was selfish.
Oh, Lordy. So...
He would be quite happy to tell you that now himself, is that, you know, he thinks their action was selfish.
And so lastly, and I'm sure you'll use indoor language, but your view of this woman having children at 50, or having a baby at 50?
Despite the fact that I am very, very grateful for my husband and I wouldn't change him for the world, anybody who consciously chooses to do that is selfish.
June, thank you. Regards to all involved. Johnny in Brixton, you're on the radio. Johnny.
Yeah, you're 59. Morning, comrade. The thing is, it's very much a personal...
I'm not 59.
Sorry?
Did you say I was 59?
Yeah, that's right, 59.
I'm not 59.
All right, names get a bit catchy, darling. Come on, embrace your age. You're 59, lad.
I am not... I'm nowhere near... Anyway, it doesn't matter how old I am. Let's talk. How old were you? How old was your? How old were you when you were born? That's a good question. I should be a journalist. How old was Mum when you were born?
No, I'm talking about personally from a male perspective. I was a daddy at 18 and also 47.
Oh, for the love of God. By the same mum?
No, hang on a minute. No. I started again. But it depends... You'd love to go there, wouldn't you? We've got that in common. But the thing is...
I don't even know what he means.
Yeah, not much you don't. The thing is, it all depends...
I wouldn't want to be a father again now. My God, you're kidding me. No way.
Well, at 59, it is stretching it a bit.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
It's time for women to say yes, yes, yes to the idea of female Viagra. That's what a drug has been dubbed in the US. It's actually called Adyai or Adi. I don't know how they're going to pronounce it. Adyai, I think. It's also, in the US, being hailed as the biggest advance in women's sexual health since the pill in the 1960s. Wow. It has been passed by the FDA, which is the all-encompassing power over in the States, the Food and Drug Administration. Without their approval, you get nowhere. And soon it'll be on the shelves in the US. Let's try and make sure we buy some, actually, and bring some over here for an experiment. Now, women in the UK, of course, crying out for similar treatment. It's not here yet, I have to be honest. But if it was here, would you take it? Some background. Men have 26 different drugs available to treat sexual dysfunction. For the women, there's nothing. The drug is made by Sprout Pharmaceuticals. It's intended to treat hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, where a lack of sexual desire causes distress. It's estimated around 1 in 10 women suffer from HSDD at some point. Now, I don't know whether that's in the UK or in the US or in the whole of the world, but there we are, 10%. You take Adi or Adyai once a day. Regulators said it's safe only for women who've not reached menopause. And also, you shouldn't use it if you use alcohol. It launches in the US... in October. Okay, ladies, would you take it? Fellas, how would you feel if your wife, your partner, your girlfriend, your mistress started taking female... I'm afraid it's going to be known as female Viagra, we just accept it. Dr. Jeff Hackett is a consultant in sexual medicine at Heartlands Hospital in Birmingham. What might this do to the sexual landscape of Britain, Dr. Campbell? Good morning.
Well, it's Dr. Hackett.
Dr. Hackett, I'm so sorry. I misread another name. Sorry, Dr. Hackett, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think it will make a big difference, but as you've rightly said, to a small number of women. The important thing is that although women tend to lose their sexual desire as they get older, the important thing is they're not, a lot of them aren't bothered by it, but there are a group of less than 10% of women where this ruins their lives. They can't form any relationships, and everyone they do breaks down quickly. And they're crying out for treatment, and there's been, as you've said, there's been nothing for them. I did trials on this, the drug which has the chemical name flibanserin, back in 2008-2009. There are only about six centres in the UK that did. And we found some very impressive results.
What were the results? Without being, and I know I can rely on you to realise, yeah. Dr. Hackett, there are children listening, but what were some of those results then?
Well, there were a couple of, if you think that we only had 20 patients and 10 of those were on placebo, because
right.
All these studies were placebo-controlled, we found that on average, the patients had one or two satisfactory experiences per month, which might not sound a lot, but it's
right.
a lot for them.
Yes.
And I remember one particular woman who had been totally unable to form any relationship, and on the basis of going on this drug in the trial, she actually got married.
Oh, wow.
During the trial period. But when the trial was over and we couldn't give her the drug, I later found out that they'd separated because a problem
had
come back and the marriage broke down. So that really gives
But isn't that a danger, Dr. Hackett? If I may paint a hypothetical situation. A couple have been together, and when they first met, as there often is, there was a lot of arousal. So ladies and gentlemen, as we're going to call it, was flourishing and fantastic. And then children came along and yada, yada, yada. And then they guess reach a certain stage in their life. No one's seeing anyone else. They're just a little bit slower. There are other things to worry about. Suddenly, mum gets hold of female Viagra and is just wants to go like the clappers. What happens to the poor old bloke?
Well, what you're talking about now is the type of patient that you didn't describe in your initial introduction. And this is why we need physicians to evaluate.
Well, no, you don't, because you'll just go to the chemist and pay $75 from October, $75, and you'll have it. So that's about 50 quid, isn't it?
Well, they do things differently in America. As I understand it, it's going to be a prescribed drug.
Oh, really? I thought you just went...
because it's a class of drug called an SSRI.
OK, well, let's not get hung up on that. But, I mean, that could cause a lot of problems, couldn't it? Because I don't need to tell you that the mechanics of the sexual act are different, of course, for each gender.
Well, I can remember when Viagra came out, there was exactly the same concern that a lot of men who didn't need it would take it and go off and have affairs. But
really?
Here we are 15 years on.
Yeah.
And that clearly hasn't happened. But
please stay on the line, Dr. Hackett. I'm going to speak with Kate Campbell, who's a relationship therapist. Do you have any concerns, Kate Campbell? Good morning.
Oh, hi. I'm not concerned, but I think I don't think it's going to work as well as people might think. For a start, if you can't take it with alcohol, that rules out an awful lot of people's sex lives immediately.
Yes.
And women's sexual desire is so much more complex than men's. I mean, it's now thought much more that desire is, waning desire is a part of modern living. It's not. It happens to men as well as women.
In what way? Why is it part of modern living?
What this drug does is...
No, waning desire. How is that part of modern living?
Well, the drug interferes with waning desire by taking you away from distractions to desire. That's the idea, that you don't get so distracted. And waning desire is associated with distraction because, for instance, I mean, if you're very, very busy and you need to get up in the morning and make the sandwiches and you're very preoccupied, desire is probably the last thing on your mind. The drug won't deal with that. For some people, it might deal with something, but it won't deal with things like distractions. I'm a sex therapist. When I see clients, very often they say they have no desire on a day-to-day basis, but it reappears when they're on holiday, for instance, which tends to suggest it's something to do with their lives rather than their desire per se.
So in a sense then, this, I suppose dangerous is too strong, this could be unsettling, the use of this drug then?
Unsettling. I don't think people... I think there are some people who are going to like the idea that a drug can fix things for them. But if you think about the kinds of people that the doctor was discussing, they're people who have difficulty forming relationships, and the drug is actually an antidepressant. So if you've got problems with forming relationships, being able to have sex is not necessarily going to make it more possible for you to have relationships. It might make you feel a bit more confident. So the effect may not be as direct as it appears to be on paper.
You're a sex therapist, so I can go into fairly direct terms and conversation with you. Am I right in thinking that in broad terms, for a man, attraction can almost be simply visual, whereas for a woman it's far more of the mind and emotional?
Yeah, I think a lot of people feel that, although for a lot of men it's emotional too.
Really?
And, I mean, it's been discovered through lots of research over the past 10 or 20 years that women's desire tends to be much more responsive than men's, so that they will not feel desire until after they feel arousal, which is why a lot of men persist, you know, in trying to encourage their partners to get interested. But it turns out that a third of men are like that too.
A third of men are like what? They don't. Hang on.
A third of men don't actually feel desire until they're aroused. So they need the trigger to arousal before they feel the desire.
Do you suppose women think a bloke should be, excuse my language here, ready for action straight away? Do you think women expect
that's
it?
There's an enormous pressure on people. And
there's enormous pressure on men. It's not easy being a man, Kate.
Well, it's great. I mean,
I wish somebody had some sympathy for what we blokes are going through. No one understands us.
It's a problem for your partner, but you are not necessarily, you know, typical of all men. You know, there are lots of men who aren't ready for action all the time. There are lots of men who feel they ought to be, and that's as much of a pressure as anything else. And in fact, it can affect performance and cause some of the problems that Viagra treats.
What for the blokes, because they think they should be ready to go.
They think they should, and because they're so fixated on performance.
Oh, of course, it's not going to happen.
Their performance.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Got it.
Yeah. So, and there are so many things. I mean, one of the things as sex therapists, one of the things that we do is actually get couples to find time for sex, because you know, these days everyone's so busy. We actually say diarise it.
Please, no. Kate, I was getting on so well with you.
Yes,
I mean, Saturday, 10:30 at night, a bit of ha ha. Come on.
You actually have to find a time that suits you when it is actually possible to relax and put all those other things out of your mind and just get on with it. And for some couples, it really does mean saying, OK, it's got to be, you know, Sunday afternoon when the kids are brownies or something.
Well, I hope so. Yeah, what were you going to say then? Kate, you're great fun. Thank you for your time. Final question to Dr. Hackett. Dr. Hackett, in a sentence, do you think lots of women are going to avail themselves of this in the UK?
Well, just quickly, if I could say...
Oh, please, yes, of course, sir.
...what Kate said is very sensible, but this drug isn't to replace sex therapy and lifestyle change.
Right.
It's to be used in addition, not to replace all the good work that Kate does and all the common sense that she said. I think this drug will be appropriate for a small number of women in the UK.
Thanks to you, Dr. Jeff Hackett. You're a consultant in sexual medicine at Heartlands Hospital in Birmingham. You also heard from Kate Campbell, a relationship therapist.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Unemployed young people will be ordered to attend a 3-week boot camp to help them get back into work. You'll hear this from the government later today. Indeed, you'll be hearing from the minister involved later in this hour. The compulsory programmes will take place in job centre classrooms throughout the country and are for people aged between 18 and 21 to put them through their paces to find work or training within 6 months. From April 2017, so there's a bit of time to go yet, April 2017, when the scheme is introduced, under-21s would lose all benefits after being unemployed for 6 months. Under-21s all gone after 6 months. They will then be ordered to attend the classes in the first 3 weeks of claiming out-of-work payments. The 71 hours of training will be built around an intensive curriculum, including practicing job applications and interview techniques. Those attending will undertake an extensive job search alongside a dedicated coach with whom they will continue to work throughout the first 6 months of unemployment. A senior Cabinet Office source tells The Times any 18 to 21-year-old not in education, training or work would have to attend the boot camps as part of the Universal Credit programme. Official figures last week show the youth unemployment rose to 16% between April and June this year, compared with 15.9%. It is marginal. What does that mean? Well, in real terms, those aged between 16 and 24, around 738,000 of them. It's going to be a lot of boot camps, isn't it? Let's speak with someone to give us some pointers around our conversation. As I say, the government is making someone available later in the hour. Claire Laker-Mansfield is with Youth Fight for Jobs, joins me now. Just explain to my listeners, what does Youth Fight for Jobs do? Good morning.
Well, we're a campaign which has been highlighting the issue of youth unemployment and, in general, a lack of decent opportunities for young people since 2009. And we've obviously heard about this scheme this morning.
Mm.
And we're quite angry about it, actually. We think, in reality, this is about criminalising young people, treating young people who are through no fault of their own, in reality, out of work, as though, you know, they're the ones who've done something wrong. And I think it's really about distracting from the failures of this government and their policies.
In what way are people being criminalised?
Well, this kind of language of punishment, of forcing young people to undertake...
Sorry, I don't see where's the punishment?
Well, are we talking about compulsory community work and...
Compulsory training programme.
Yeah, compulsory training programmes. We've also had the government talking about community work and so on. But this element of the idea that unless there's a sort of metaphorical gun held to the head of a young person, they're not going to bother to look for jobs is not true. What the government is doing is investing in proper opportunities in jobs which are paid a living wage, not forcing people to work for their benefits.
But Ms. Laker-Mansfield, if you have a young man or woman who, for whatever reason, isn't particularly well equipped to write a letter or present his or herself at an interview or could do with some techniques or tips, what's so wrong with a system in which he or she can actually learn to make better applications and possibly to get that job? I don't see why you're opposition.
Well, I'm in favour of young people being given support, absolutely.
Well, that's what this is, then. And so can I take it from you, you've changed your position
element,
now?
No, what I'm opposed to is the element of compulsion involved. It's about it is in reality about trying to force more young people off benefits and into, in reality, destitution. And we've seen, you know, the spike in the numbers of people going to food banks and so on.
No.
And actually, a lot of young people would be better off just being able to use their own time to find a job. But even better than that, why doesn't the government invest in decent jobs for young people, in jobs which are paid at the very minimum, the minimum wage, which is what you should get for a day's work? We're talking about people being asked to work 30 hours a week, which is, you know, what a lot of people work in a full-time job, for no money at all. That's not right, is it, surely?
Have you had an opportunity to fully study this?
I've read the news stories about it this morning.
I haven't fully studied it, though.
It's only been announced this morning.
The language is that you're employing at the moment is almost as if, well, in fact, you have said the word criminalise. All that it's saying is, if you're in this particular age group and you've been unable to land employment, they want you to attend some kind of course or curriculum where they will help you get a job. And you're speaking... I mean, I can almost hear the rage coming down the phone lines. What's so wrong with trying to help young people get a job? And to ensure that you actually... Because let's face it, I have been one and I've raised two children. Some people in that age group sometimes need a little bit of incentive to achieve anything. So here we are. You better come and see us, otherwise we'll switch off the cash. But we don't want to switch off the cash. We just want you to attend. Where's the problem?
Well, for a start, the language which the government used, I think, is deliberately provocative. They've talked about boot camps, language which sometimes when you're talking about what you should do
In fairness, I'm so sorry, it's the newspaper that says boot camp, actually.
Well, I think that's come from the government, in reality. They want it to be presented like that, because that's what they want to appear. They're saying, we're being tough on young unemployed people. The whole way through the last government and through this, there's been an attempt to say that young people are unemployed, not because of the massive mess that's been made of the economy, the crash, not because of austerity and all of the attacks that we're making on jobs, but because young people can't get themselves out of bed in the morning. That is actually what is going on here.
In some cases, yes.
We would say that that is not true at all.
Well, at all. So every single young person who's unemployed, they're all out there every morning, getting up at 8, writing letters, sending emails, making phone calls.
Look, I can't speak.
And there goes a pig right by the window as we speak, madam.
I cannot speak for every young person in the country.
You.
But the truth is there's been a massive spike in unemployment over the last few years as a whole, and that has not come because of some kind of some spike in laziness. It's come because of the massive crash that there was, which was caused by bankers, by big business, by the rich in reality, and then the austerity policies which this government has carried through. That is why youth unemployment has gone up. It's got nothing to do with some kind of, you know, something for nothing culture, young people who think they can spend a lot on benefits, the well-trodden path, as Cameron said this morning, or Hancock, sorry. You know, none of that is, in our view, what is going on here.
All right, that's Matthew Hancock. You're referring to the Conservative Paymaster General. Claire Laker-Mansfield, thank you. You're with the organisation Youth Fight for Jobs. To the person who's going to be outlining these plans later today, Matthew Hancock, Paymaster General, Conservative MP for West Suffolk, joins me now. What would you call them, sir, and how do they work? Good morning.
Good morning. Well, it's about intensive support. You call them what you will, intensive support.
Can I call them boot camps?
Yeah, call them a boot camp if you want to. What they are is a three-week period, 71 hours over 3 weeks, of intensive support, including personal mentoring from one-to-one support for young people under the age of 21 who become unemployed, to give them the skills and the wherewithal and what it takes to get a job. Because we all know that if you are unemployed when you're young, that not only damages your earnings then, but it also hits your earnings over your whole life. All the evidence shows that it is very bad, especially when you're young. So we want to give people extra support with very strong incentives that they take it up.
What will they learn, the young people?
Well, it'll be tailored to each person, but they will learn, for instance, from CV writing and interview techniques, all the way through to what some people call soft skills, but I think are pretty core skills of, mm-hmm. you know, the things you need to be able to do to hold down a job, working as a team, turning up on time, following instructions carefully and promptly. Some people just don't. Simply haven't come across the need to do these things. And so it's about making sure that they get that individual mentoring.
Shouldn't it have been provided at school or college, Mr. Hancock?
Well, of course, we're reforming schools as well, and we've extended the range of careers advice, the ages at which you get careers advice at school. And we're also pushing work experience because, you know, actual experience of being in work is one of the single best things that can help you to get especially that first job. It's just so you know what it feels like. So we're pushing that at school as well. And, you know, as you'll know, we've got a big programme of education reform on. That's partly why this is, you know, this is a cross-government effort. It's about the benefits system and the incentives in that, what happens in job centres, and about schools and the relationship with businesses, because ultimately it's businesses who create these jobs.
Who'll be doing the teaching and mentoring?
Well, in the first instance, it's going to be job centre plus staff. As youth unemployment has fallen, we can give more support to those who remain unemployed.
No, but who'll be doing the teaching, was my question, Mr. Hancock.
Well, it'll be the job centre plus staff who
already, so they're trained in this, are they?
They are. They're trained in helping young people to get work. But, you know, this is being brought in by April 2017, so we'll make sure we've got the people to do it in the, 18 months between now and then.
And someone does not attend, at what point do their benefits get switched off then?
Well, if they don't attend, then they won't be eligible for benefits. And that decision is also taken within the job centre, in the same way that the conditionality on, as we call it, on benefits for people of all ages takes place now.
But they can come back. If that gives them a sort of wake-up call, they can then come banging on the door and saying, oops, can I come in now?
Well, that's how the conditionality system works, yeah, is normally a temporary period in which you can't claim the benefits. These so-called sanctions, and normally when people get them, you know, that is quite a
wake-up call, as we call it. You'll be aware, probably better than I am, that it was revealed last week that the number of people aged 16 to 24 currently out of employment is 738,000, Mr. Hancock. Whose fault is that?
Well, it's a very good question. It's a combination of things. Look, it's been falling over the last 5 years or so. It started going up in the mid 2000s, even before the crash. Mm. Then it was seriously exacerbated by the crash. It's been coming down pretty sharply over the last 5 years or so. But for me, in a way, you know, the numbers, of course, are important. But anybody who is young and long-term unemployed. That is too many for me. We want to abolish long-term youth unemployment altogether.
But so, are you saying there are 738,000 jobs out there?
Actually, if you look at the amount of vacancies, it is about that level. There's record numbers of vacancies.
So it is their fault?
No, it's about matching. It's about making sure that people have the right incentives. It's about making sure people have the right skills. This isn't about blame. It is about support and incentives, a carrot and stick approach.
All right. That's what I finish with. You say carrot and stick. I wonder, Mr. Hancock, if there's too much stick. You said I could call them boot camps. You'd be relaxed with that. Let me tell you that a boot camp is either a military training camp for new recruits with harsh discipline or a prison for young offenders run on military lines. Is that what you're seeking to portray with this idea, Mr. Hancock?
Or an intensive support system for people under the age of 21.
Well, you made that one up as you went along, didn't you? Really, in reality, Mr. Hancock.
But, you know, the point is this. We want to end long-term youth unemployment. We want to end this cycle of...
Just don't call it a boot camp.
You know what? We want to end this cycle of dependency. We need to make sure this support is tough, but it also gives people what they need to help them to get a job. And you know, what matters more than the name you give it is the fact that we're doing everything we can to help young people to get into work.
Matthew Hancock, your Paymaster General, Conservative MP for West Suffolk.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Well, one of the big Labour heavy hitters, one of the big beasts, has finally entered the debate about the leadership of the party. This, as more than 610,000 Labour backers will today receive ballot papers. And then they have to choose between Jeremy Corbyn and, of course, the rivals, Liz Kendall, Yvette Cooper and Andy Burnham. The line of people who are coming in to say, don't vote Corbyn, gets ever longer. Yesterday it was the turn of Gordon Brown. He spoke for the best part of an hour, and you didn't see it on television. That will explain the context of how we start this. And he literally did not stop moving. 5 or 6 metres to the left from the centre of the podium, and then all the way about 12, 15 metres to the other side of the room, and then turned round and came all the way back. He was, as with the Scottish referendum, he was well informed. He spoke well. He's a very articulate bloke. There's no question about it, but... Why, it's on the website, by the way, lbc.co.uk, lbc.co.uk. Goodness knows, perhaps he's in secret training for a marathon or something. Goodness knows how many miles he clocked up.
We are grieving. The only way that we can avert the pain and end the suffering is by securing in future the election of a Labour government to deliver on our priorities.
You keep saying you got something for me.
And when I see the opinion polls that say that the one grouping in the party that is likely to get most votes is the one grouping that even its own supporters say is least likely to be able to form a government, then we have to look at the lessons of our history. What I'm here to say is that the best way of realising our high ideals is to show that we have an alternative in government that is credible, is radical and is electable.
One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
And on and on and on the former Prime Minister went, either directly quoting or mentioning everyone from Nelson Mandela to Emma Thompson to Nye Bevin and Amy Winehouse, but not a mention of Jeremy Corbyn. How effective is it? Owen Jones, broadcaster, author, columnist for The Guardian, joins me now. Did it hit the spot, Owen?
I don't think it's going to do the job, to be honest with you. I think it's not going to be as helpful to Jeremy Corbyn as Tony Blair's interventions. I think Tony Blair's basically become Jeremy Corbyn's PR manager. Every time Tony Blair speaks about heart transplants and issues apocalyptic warnings, I think Jeremy Corbyn's vote jumps up, and that's because Tony Blair is a far more divisive figure. I think the thing with Gordon Brown is I think he sums up the whole problem in this contest for those that faction of the party that wants to defeat Jeremy Corbyn, because they're very good at saying why people shouldn't vote for Jeremy Corbyn for lots of largely quite negative reasons, but they haven't put forward an inspiring vision of their own. And that's, again, what Gordon Brown failed to do yesterday. Lots of eloquent stuff about Labour's history. I found some of the anecdotes myself quite interesting and thoughtful. But in terms of a genuine inspiring, this is the alternative, this is what Labour could be doing instead, it's just not there, and that's one of the main reasons I think Jeremy Corbyn's doing so well, to be honest.
And I do mean, when I say these words, Owen, is it not there because it's not there, if you know what I mean? They actually haven't got anything that they can preach.
I think that's spot on, yeah. And I think the reason for it is, you know, I have lots of criticisms, to say the least, of New Labour. But New Labour did have things, didn't it? It had things like spend on public services and invest in them. Well, because now those people who kind of keep the whole New Labour flame burning have accepted austerity, and they think, you know, the whole argument is you know, almost opposing spending on public services, there's not much left for them to say. I mean, they had LGBT rights as well, which they did in government, which was great, but everyone accepts that now. Devolution, the same. It's difficult for them to come up with an inspiring, coherent alternative. There's not much left for them to say. But with the case of Jeremy Corbyn, he has huge numbers of things to say. I mean, people, whether people like those policies or visions or not, I'm very sympathetic to them. Some of your listeners won't be. But it is definitely there. And it's filled a vacuum. It is inspiring people. And there's nothing, I don't think, you know, Yvette Cooper or Andy Burnham or Liz Kendall, they failed to come up with an inspiring, coherent alternative and instead come across as quite technocratic, professionalised politicians, and I think people are sick of that as well.
In its coverage, The Guardian, the newspaper you work for, puts the dig at Mr Corbyn's foreign policy right at the top by about paragraph 3 or 4. In the most explicit warning so far about Jeremy Corbyn's foreign policy, The Guardian writes, Mr Brown said, "Don't tell me that we can do much for the poor of the world if the alliances we favour most are with Hezbollah, Hamas, Chavez's successor in Venezuela and Putin's totalitarian Russia." Is this a soft spot for Corbyn?
Well, I think that's a very silly caricature, I have to say. And, I mean, if you take, you know, Putin's Russia, Jeremy Corbyn's been campaigning for Chechen human rights for years when, frankly, New Labour, when they were in power, were actually giving cover to what Vladimir Putin was doing with Russia. And indeed, Tony Blair has actually called for an alliance with Putin against the so-called Islamic fundamentalist terrorism. So, you know, and again, the Hezbollah and Hamas, well, you know, Jeremy Corbyn calls for peace and negotiations in the Middle East, which means bringing in people who are often quite unsavoury. Back in the 1980s, he said people should negotiate with Sinn Féin. That was seen as extreme, but then became seen as the mainstream thing to do. So, no, I think, obviously, Jeremy Corbyn would have to support a foreign policy based on human rights. I think that would mean questioning our alliances at the moment with dictatorships like Saudi Arabia, which I think at the very heart of Islamic fundamentalism and forms of terrorism. I think he's questioning that. But it would actually have to be, again, it would have to be working on the basis of international cooperation as well as human rights. So I think that is an unfair caricature, which is not going to help their cause again, I think.
I don't know where you stand on the wide-held belief that his, Gordon Brown's, intervention in the Scottish referendum was fairly influential. If you agree with that, Owen Jones, do you think he might have the same impact here?
I don't think I do buy that. And I think the problem with that whole referendum campaign generally, whatever you think about independence, was it was often a campaign of fear. And I think that actually boosted, in the end, support for independence. Because originally, remember back in the early days of the referendum, people thought it'd be completely walked. That, you know, yes, people would vote 70% against independence, just 30% would vote for it. In the end, it was 55-45. And I think, basically, the fact it looked like the establishment was pulling rank together with often a message of fear, I think in the end helped boost support for independence. And in a small way, you can see that here, because there's similarities. People up in arms against the party against an establishment, a sense of frustration and anger at the status quo, feeling inspired by something else, and then the establishment closing rank to make people feel scared about doing so.
I will leave that. Owen Jones, thank you. Broadcaster, author, columnist for The Guardian newspaper, 13 after 8. Important, then, that we give the political aspect, and I want to hear what you thought of it, what you made of it, and also on the human side of it, the extraordinary. When I watched it, I can't remember what time I saw it. It was quite late last night. I could not, but I'd heard it on the radio. But he's just marching up and down. Sorry, that's not actually fair. Left to right, as I should have said. Why? Jez Rose is a behaviourist and behavioural expert. Joins me now. Jez Rose, why typically do people stomp up and down when they're talking to people?
Well, it's a physiological response normally. You know, your heart rate goes up due to a number of factors. That could be fear, for example, or anger, or lack of confidence. And the lack of confidence might come in the content. So, you know, benignly, you might not have rehearsed it enough. Or in the environment, for example. And so what happens is your heart rate goes up and you need to get rid of that energy. So some people wring their hands and most people, you know, pace like that. But it was a bit caged lioness, wasn't it?
It really was. Did he look at ease with himself?
Well, the interesting thing is, you know, I look at that from lots of different perspectives, and I'm looking at all different types of things. And he the way he presents, if you compare that to what we've seen before, he was pretty confident, pretty in control. You know, there was consistency in the tone of his voice and the sorts of language it was using. But there was a slight nervousness to his... He wasn't as relaxed as he has been before. And if you look at other times that he's presented, both in the Commons and outside, he normally stands still. You know, we don't really think of Gordon Brown as a pacer, do we?
No.
So there was something about that, that either the content or perhaps the environment, difficult to say, that he wasn't comfortable with. I don't think he was angry, to be honest.
You don't, because often people, it is a way of sort of working out a certain level of frustration, isn't it, and or anger.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you often see that in the raging CEO in the boardroom. You know, they can't sit there and be nice about it. They have to sort of throw their anger around through physicality. But certainly the language he was using and the way in which he was presenting wouldn't have suggested outright anger in that way. Certainly not strong enough to have not been suppressed. So it's something else, and perhaps it was a lack of confidence in the content, you know, in the things he was having to say, or perhaps the environment he was in. Perhaps he just wasn't happy about having to say what he had to say in that area.
And lastly, I call you this afternoon and I say, Jez, I've got a big speech I've got to give next week, and I'm coming up with this idea. I'm going to do it without notes, and I'm just going to march. I'm just going to walk from left to right, left to right, left to right repeatedly. Do you think it's a good idea? What would you say?
I'd say, no, don't do that. Get somebody else to do it. My three top tips are this. Number one, before you start, take a nice deep breath and give yourself a good run-up so you've got a bit of distance to walk up and get rid of some of that energy. And the most important thing is this. Keep both feet flat on the floor and push your toes into the floor without lifting your heels up, because it's extremely difficult to move when you're forcing your feet into the ground.
Well, there's a clue. Anybody having to give a speech at a wedding or something this coming weekend or whatever it might be, push your toes into the ground without lifting your feet up. Jez Rose, thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Now, this statistic shocked me. Half of adults have not been to the dentist in the past 2 years. Oh! What's their breath going to be like? Health chiefs are warning about limited access to NHS dentists. Figures released even by the Health and Social Care Information Centre showed a drop in the number of people seen by an NHS dentist. Then there's a whole slew of statistics I won't trouble you with. The key is the one I've already said, one in two. Let's speak to a dentist then. Dr. Nick Fabry has been practising for 15 years. He's a dentist, joins me now. Dr. Fabry, let's talk about the problem with the NHS. Is it down to funding? Is it down to lack of knowledge? What's going on here? Good morning.
Morning. Well, the problem with the NHS is that it's a complicated system for dentists to understand, so we don't really expect the patients to understand either.
Mm.
In a nutshell, it comes down to every practice has limited funding, and when that funding has expired, you don't have the capacity to see any more patients.
Really? So if, I mean, this is really silly, but I don't know, let's say you're paid calendar year. If by about July or August you've had to do a lot of crowns and implants and whatever else is expensive, I mean, you're out of cash, that's it.
Well, the mandate is upon the dentist to actually spread their funding out throughout the year so they don't have a glut at the end, or they don't run out prematurely. You get your budget at the beginning of the year, which is allocated by the health authority, and you're meant to spread it out in 12 monthly tranches.
How welcoming of that is the dental industry? Because I would imagine when you were going through all your training, it was because you wanted to work with people's teeth, not be an accountant.
I speak for myself and just about every other dentist I know. We absolutely despise it. It's a ridiculous system, but that's just my opinion and not necessarily the opinion of everyone.
How did it used to run, Mr. Fabry? I know you've been in the profession for 15 years. I can't imagine it was running like this 15 years ago. How was it run, and was it better?
The problem is that both ways were open to had problems. The previous way was that it was essentially, if you went to have work done, you just, as a patient, you just paid for whatever needs to be done. And if your practice could take on 10,000 patients, you were able to see them. And then it was changed to kind of a yearly grant.
So but I don't understand. You take on me, right, and I don't need much work, but then you take on someone else and they need ceaseless work and you're seeing them every third week. What you're pay, the NHS paid you per appointment, did they, or did you just get a flat rate per patient?
In the old ways, you had, it was called fee per item. So you did a checkup, you got paid for a checkup. You did a filling, you got paid for filling. Now you just, there's three bands of treatment, and you get, depending on which band you fall into, you get paid a different amount.
And I suppose that previous way, what was not you, of course, but that previous way was open to abuse, because if I needed to pay my son's school fees and I was a dentist, I'd just throw in a few extra fillings to top up the cash. Is that what was happening?
There's abuse of the system, and that's, I think, probably why it changed. But neither system works, and the dentists generally are very, very unhappy with the NHS contract.
Lastly, coming back to your area of expertise, away from money and back to teeth, how much, potentially, how much damage might one be doing, how might you be doing to your own teeth, if you didn't see a dentist for 2 years, and let alone your breath? God almighty.
Well, I mean, you know, there are two things. Number one is your teeth. Small holes in teeth tend to become bigger and thus need more complicated treatment. Oh. The second problem is to do with your gums. Your gum health really needs constant attention. And if you're not seeing a hygienist or getting, you know, some gum work done, that's where you start to lose teeth. Because eventually your jawbone just shrinks and your teeth get loose and fall out.
Oh, doctor, thank you. Nick Fabry, dentist, practising for more than 15 years. Let's talk dentistry. John in Eastbourne. What can you tell me, John? Good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Nick. I think we're at quite a ridiculous situation now, because anyone who's, say, on full benefits, shall we say, can go to any National Health dentist and have any treatment they require with no worries in their mind about what it's going to cost them, you know? Whereas anyone, say, working on minimum wage or around that limit, if they go to a dentist and they're going to be charged crazy sums nowadays on National Health, even, say, just for one crown is over £225 on National Health.
And is that right?
That's the reason so many people aren't going to dentists, in fear of what it's going to cost them.
Well, not if it's NHS.
Well, no, that's NHS charge. Just for one crown is over £225. £5. I know that myself, so I went there.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I'm so stupid, because I'm fortunate enough to have private dental care. So you have to pay, an NHS patient pays £220 for a crown.
That's right. It's just for one crown. That's what happened to me. I mean, I went to the dentist myself, Nick, not realising that. I'm a National Health patient.
What's a filling? I mean, I know what it is. What is the cost of a filling?
I think a filling now is around about £50 for one filling, you know?
Right.
But the ridiculous situation we've got, Nick, anyone, you know, I'm not declaring someone on benefits, but if you're on full benefits, you can go to a dentist with no worries about that. Whatever the dentist recommends, you can have it done free of charge.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're working on minimum wage or around trying to...
How interesting.
You're restricted because that is a charge. I
mean, got it. No, John, you've made a light go on in my head here. So, lastly, if you go for a checkup and everything's everything's fine, yep. Is there a fee paid?
You used to have to pay £17, I believe it is, for an NH checkup on your teeth, you know?
Wow. No, when the dentists are all driving around in Jaguars, it's not bad business, is it? Mind you, a lot of training. I wouldn't want to look. Do you know dentists have among the highest suicide rate in the US? I don't know about the UK. Dentists, bus drivers, and postal workers. What's that all about? Three of the highest professions of suicide. Imagine if your dentist likes driving a bus at weekends. You haven't got long, have you? Dentists, postal workers and bus drivers, among the highest suicides in the whole of the US. I don't know why I tell you that, but it's something that will stick in your head this weekend. Genevieve's in Crystal Palace. Hello, Genevieve.
Oh, hello. Good morning, Nick.
You're on the radio. What can you tell me?
I just wanted to clear something up, because I actually went to my dentist last week and I asked her straight. I said, what is the problem with the contract that you have?
Oh, yeah.
And how she explained it to me was that there are three bands of payment, and before, dentists used to get paid for everything they did at that time.
Mm.
So one filling, they'd get paid. Mm. Now on these levels, she explained, whether you have one filling or 10 fillings, they get paid the same amount. And that is the issue.
Well, the dentist just paid us, told us they were paid in band levels. Do you remember, on the amount?
Everything up to that £50, £55 band is fillings.
Right.
So as she explained it to me, if you have one filling, we charge £55. If you have 10, that's what we charge.
Yes, yes.
And as she explained it to me, I could see that it was slightly unfair.
Yes, yes.
Because they just, you know, and as that other chap, he said that he went and had the crown and he paid £250. If he'd needed 3 crowns, he still would have paid the 250, because that's the maximum you pay.
Yeah, it's a difficult job anyway, I would imagine.
No, I'm sure it is. Mm. I'm sure it is. And but I do feel that that is the issue with the dentists, is that there's these 3 bands, and they feel that it's unfair, because no matter how much work they do in that band, that's all they get paid.
Thank you for that. Norman's in Paddington. What can you tell me about it, Norman? Good morning.
Good morning to you, Nick. Look, I've heard all this talk about bands, and you have so many fillings, and the dentist gets paid this and that. The truth of the matter is that what we need to recognise, that the dental industry in this country is a national disgrace.
Why?
It is, because it's not run in a proper way. Dentists can take advantage of the system. It's not monitored properly. There's not enough investment to the National Health Service in dentistry.
We spend £2 billion a week on the National Health Service. How much more do you want?
It's how you spend it and how it's managed. That is the problem, because there's so many dentists that have been taken before the courts because they have been making false claims. There's a lot of scandal regarding dentistry. I honestly believe this, and I know from personal experience, in the sense that you can probably hear, I've got my plate out at the moment, so my voice is a bit strange. Mm. But the truth of the matter is, there should be a lot of education as well. It needs a total revamp, it really does, and I'm not surprised, as you said earlier, that a lot of them aren't just running around in Jaguars. I dare say a few of them have got Bentleys and Rolls Royces. It's a scandal, it really is, and we're not being served well by the National Health Service with regard to dentistry, and it needs a public inquiry, it needs a revamp.
Whoa, you've just heard a dentist explain that they're not happy with it either.
Well, then it's the government's fault, isn't it, if they're not happy? So we need the government...
No, hang on. Whoa. If firefighters are unhappy, we wouldn't say it's the government's fault, would we?
Of course we do, but it's the management. Well, the management of the...
Right, so the management of the firefighters... Hold on. The management of the firefighters, as much as the management of the dentists, aren't government-appointed...
The fact of the matter is they oversee the National Health Service, the government, and the way it deals with National Health Service patients. Throughout this country, I believe it's not so bad in the towns, there are people struggling to find dentists, so that they can have the satisfactory dental work done. I'm not joking, I'm very serious about this. I think your listeners should contact their MPs, should demand that we have a better dental service that we can be proud of and not have to fly off to Europe to get a sort of implants that are half the price in abroad that they are here.
Norman, thank you. Staying with dentistry, Andy's in Bolton. You're on the radio. Andy, hello.
Hi, Nick. My fiance is actually a dentist, and she just left the NHS to work with the RAF as a dentist.
Oh, right.
Basically because of the contract that she's on with the NHS. People think that when they go and they have a filling and they pay £50, the dentist gets £50. The dentist doesn't. They get what they call a UDA, which might be £10 or £11 out of the 50, you know, and basically what the government have basically turned dentistry into piecework, because if a dentist doesn't hit the target for the month, then they actually, the government claws, or the NHS claws back money from the dentist. So say, for example, a dentist is on a contract that's worth, for example, £5,000 a month.
Yeah.
If they don't hit the target, they could fall back, potentially.
But how hard is it to hit the target? Is that target easily attainable, or is it very difficult?
It depends on the area, you know. If people don't turn in, obviously, for an appointment, there's no sort of comeback then. You know, the dentist loses out on that target. If the dentist has a full week of exams, they're not going to hit the targets again.
All right, good luck to your fiancé. Thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
The Chilcot inquiry seems to go on and on and on, and yet more pressure now being piled on the career civil servants of John Chilcot, who must wonder why he ever took the phone call suggesting he would head up at this inquiry. We now know, of course, about the understandable grief and anguish of some of the relatives and the legal action that is ensuing as a result of that. But also, to give it a political slant as well, Jeremy Corbyn, the man who still seems to be nailed on to be the next Labour leader, and we will know, thank the Lord, in less than a month, He would be ready to issue a public apology over the Iraq war on behalf of the party if he wins next month. This, of course, a move Tony Blair repeatedly resisted, as did Ed Miliband this year, just prior to general election. In a statement to one of the newspapers, The Guardian, Mr Corbyn said he would apologise to the British people for the, quote, deception in the run-up to the 2003 invasion, and also apologise to the Iraqi people for their subsequent suffering. Such an apology would, says The Guardian, be symbolically important, particularly in a party where Iraq remains painful 12 years after Britain joined the US in the invasion. In another aspect to this story that just won't go away, the head of the armed forces will be criticised by the Chilcot Inquiry. This is the front page of a different national newspaper, The Times. General Sir Nicholas Houghton, David Cameron's top military adviser, has been told, says the paper, he's among senior commanders to face censure in the report. And it's virtually unheard of for a serving armed forces chief to be criticised over his role in a major conflict. Well, let's get views on both these aspects of the story from Rear Admiral Chris Parry. He's a former NATO commander and joins me now. Let's come to the latter of these two, if we could first, sir. A little unfortunate, perhaps, for General Sir Nicholas Houghton.
Well, yeah, I think it's a bit unfair, actually, to put him out in front of everybody else, ahead of the pack. He's a good man, he's a good soldier. But I think we have to understand the context within which I suspect he's being criticised. He was Deputy Commanding General and the senior British representative in Baghdad in 2005. He was then Chief of Joint Operations in 2006-09. And what I think people forget after the passage of time is that we were very much the junior coalition, military coalition partner in Iraq at the time, and we know the Americans totally got the context wrong. There was also an issue that throughout the army at the time there was a systemic problem and muddled thinking about how to deal with situations like that. The army thought that because they'd done Malaya, Northern Ireland, they could hack Iraq. Of course, their lessons from those other conflicts were valid, but they weren't sufficient for this new context. And finally, I would have to say, from my own experience looking at the Chilcot Inquiry, they've been very selective about the people they call to give evidence.
If this apology, moving on to the political side, Rear Admiral, if Jeremy, and there are a couple of ifs here, of course, if Jeremy Corbyn was to win, and if he went ahead with this apology, to the families of those who lost their lives and to others who lost their limbs or their emotional stability, would it be enough?
Well, I think, you know, who does get things right in conflicts? Wars are very fast-moving situations. Mistakes do happen. They've happened in every conflict in which Britain has been involved. I'm not quite sure what we're apologising for. A previous inquiry said there was no deception. We have to believe that, of course. I'm not a great believer in inquiries as getting at the truth. They're generally there as political fig leaves. And I think with the Chilcot inquiry, as with any other inquiry, we have to look at the motivations behind the people setting up the inquiry. We also have to look at who is influencing decision makers, the politicians and the other senior military figures who also have a vested interest in the outcome of these inquiries. I think apologising for getting involved in Iraq is a bit ridiculous, actually. I mean, you make policy decisions based on what you think are the country's interests. If you can prove criminal or malign behaviour, then do so. But so far, I don't think that's been proven.
So, lastly, Rear Admiral, and this is a hideous journalistic invention, but it sums up how many people feel about the Iraq war. You don't think the government did go to war on a lie?
I didn't say that. I said that I think the evidence has not been produced to say that it was a lie.
Are you comfortable with the conflict? Obviously, you're not comfortable with the conflict. I'm sorry. Are you comfortable with the decision-making that propelled Britain into conflict?
I have to say that I'm subject to the official secret. So what I know and what I knew at the time is not something I can discuss. All I can say to you is that I gave advice at the time when I was involved, and that advice wasn't taken.
Thank you for your time. Rear Admiral Chris Parry, former NATO commander, hanging out a very interesting aspect there. Perhaps we might know more, Rear Admiral, as and when this wretched report is published. Wretched in every sense of the word, wretched in the time delay, and wretched in the subject that it has to inquire. Bill Baring is a professor of law at Birkbeck College and a barrister who specialises in international law. The validity of such an apology and the symbolism even of it. What would it mean to you, Professor? Good morning.
Good morning, Nick. I think it would be very important. Of course, Ed Miliband went so far as to say that that it was wrong to go to war in Iraq, which doesn't count as an apology. And the one thing we do know for absolute sure is that this was an illegal an illegal war.
Mm.
I think everyone has agreed on that. I think everyone's agreed that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And I think everyone's agreed that the aftermath has been absolutely disastrous for all kinds of reasons. So I don't think an apology would be out of place. But that in no way has anything to do, of course, with Chilcot itself.
And your view on the Chilcot inquiry, Professor, where do you stand on that?
Well, you know, of course, they had a very broad remit, so they had to look at the way decisions were made and actions taken to establish as accurately as possible what happened and to identify the lessons that can be learned. And when Chilcot recently went before Parliament, he was saying that, I mean, they've actually been working very hard, so I probably disagree with you on that point. I'm sure they have been working very hard.
All right.
But he was saying that they've had new evidence in. Of course, we don't know what that was. But we do know that some of the witnesses were recalled while they were taking evidence up to 2011, and I'm sure they've been getting fresh evidence since. And then you've already mentioned this Maxwellization process, in which they are being incredibly scrupulous that anyone...
Which they don't need to be, of course, Professor, as you're aware.
I'm sorry?
They don't need to employ maxwellization.
So they decided to do that. I suspect, I don't know, I'm not on the inside, but I strongly suspect that they thought that with an inquiry as potentially sensitive as this, that they should go absolutely as far as anyone has ever gone in the past and perhaps even further. The trouble is that once they have asked for these responses, they then have to think about them and to think how they are going to put this in the report. And I thoroughly agree that this has taken absolute 6 years is far too long.
Thank you very much, Adiva. Just before I let you go, the idea of the deadline and a legal aspect, and I have raised this with the former Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg, Prime Minister David Cameron and others. From your understanding, Professor, and this is, I know, desperately simplistic, but if Sir John and his team were to send out a letter and say, right, we are going to give you until October the 17th for the purpose of debate, and then that's it, that would be legally standing. That would be fair, wouldn't it?
My understanding is that actually the responses have been coming in good time, so, and the problem seems to have been in considering how to react to them and how to do the final draft of the report. And, of course, this report, the whole inquiry is not to establish any kind of liability, but to try and establish exactly what happened. And I think that is part of the difficulty. Other people may decide on liability, including the investigation currently being carried out since May of last year at the International Criminal Court. And that would look at individual, potentially, criminal liability.
I will leave it there. Professor Bill Baring, thank you. Professor of Law at Birkbeck College and a barrister specialising in international law.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
So is your pet looking as though they've got a bit of the blues, a case of the blues today? Does your dog or cat, I don't know, possibly even rabbits as well, we'll find out in a moment, just look a little bit unhappy? Well, but don't be surprised. Soaring numbers of people are reporting psychological problems for their cats and dogs and subsequently claiming on their pet insurance. It's put down to increasingly busy work lives and a rise in the internet. I suppose we spend more time on the net than talking to our animals, that might be it. This triggers a surge in levels of anxiety, depression and poor behaviour among our pets. Insurers reporting an unprecedented rise in payouts to treat emotional health problems among pets. The cooperative, which has 21,000 pet cover customers, says it's seen a six-fold rise in the number of owners claiming over the past 3 years. All right, how do you tell if your dog or your cat, possibly other animals, have got some kind of mental health, emotional health issues? Let's speak with Anna Korvanowska, who's senior trainer and animal behaviourist with Pets in Practice. They're dog and cat trainers, and they join me now. Well, first, may I call you Anna? Actually, that's my first question. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Yes, that's absolutely fine.
How can I tell if my cat or my dog has got the blues?
Well, it's very similar to what we observe in humans, really. They just seem sad, but also things like...
How does a dog seem sad?
Well, if you see your dog not doing what they normally do, so rather than playing and enjoying life and sitting in the garden and playing with the ball, they rather lie on their bed and, you know, go with their food and just don't enjoy things that they normally enjoy. You struggle to get them out for a walk. That's that could be an indication that your dog is a little bit depressed, a little bit sad, and we need to do something about it.
And what do you agree this is because in some instances owners aren't spending enough time with their pets?
I don't necessarily think that sadness or depression is due to that. If a dog or a cat is showing sort of a shift from being happy and enjoying life to all of a sudden not enjoying life anymore, it can be due to many things. Obviously, the first thing we normally suggest is take them to the vet because, you know, it might seem like they're sad or depressed, but in fact, they might be in pain. They might be suffering from a medical condition. So that's always something that we suggest to do first, just to be sure that we're not addressing a behaviour problem that actually is a medical problem.
How do you diagnose depression in a cat or a dog?
We look at things such as behaviour. So definitely we would be looking at changing in routines, a sudden change in how they behave, how they respond to us, how they interact with us. Obviously depression in animals is not the same condition as in humans, obviously, because they are so different from us.
So how do you treat it?
How we treat it? I mean, there are many ways of doing this. If the animal is sound medically, so we know that there is nothing going on when it comes to health, first, we can implement a behaviour modification programme.
Hell is a behaviour modification programme? What does that mean in English?
A behaviour modification programme is just a programme that we implement, a number of things that we suggest for the owner to do to make their animal's life a bit better. It could be changes in routine, it could be adding some games, it could be even adding medication if needed.
You give a cat Prozac or dog Prozac?
There are forms of Prozac for
animals. Oh, my God. Obviously. But how do you ever get it off?
Just like in humans.
You'll have junky cats wandering around, scoring Prozac on street corners.
No, I think it's a myth. It is a quite helpful medication in animals that need it. Obviously, we do work alongside vets because as animal behaviourists, we don't prescribe medication ourselves. But in some cases, it is really, really helpful, and it has helped many animals in our care. So we don't shy away from, looking into medication if it is something that the animal would benefit from.
Anna, thank you. I must end there only for time reasons. Fascinating speaking with you. Anna Korvenowska, who's a senior trainer and animal behaviourist at Pets in Practice. They are dog and cat trainers. Well, I talked about a cat on Prozac. It looks like I'm going to speak to someone who's had one. Barbara in Tower Bridge, you had a cat on Prozac.
I had a cat that was on Prozac because it wouldn't eat, completely depressed. It was on Prozac for 6 months and then took 6 months to get the cat off Prozac.
When you took the cat, obviously you're going to worry. If your pet's not eating, you're going to go down and say, look, to the vet, and going to say, look, I've got a problem with my cat, it's not eating. When the vet said, yes, your cat's depressed, how did you react?
I felt depressed. My cat was depressed.
How much does Prozac for a cat cost?
It's very expensive, more than human drugs.
Really? And if the cat's not eating, how do you give it Prozac?
You have to give it right down its throat.
Oh, when you force a tablet in and rub its throat so they have to swallow. Yeah, I've done that with worming tablets. But with the pets, not with me.
Is when you start Prozac with a cat, you have to keep going, you can't just stop it.
Why? What happens if you take a cat off Prozac too soon?
They get withdrawal symptoms.
How do you know a cat's got Prozac withdrawal symptoms?
Because they act like a bit like a drug addict. And she's not on anything now.
She eats happily now?
She's eating me out of house and home.
So she's obviously better.
Yeah, but I would never, ever go down that line or recommend anyone put them on Prozac or
Don't put your daughter on the stage and don't put your cat on Prozac. This is what we're saying. Barbara, look after yourself. Have a good weekend. My love to fly. Be afraid. Coming to a child, or indeed your child, near you. No, it's not a giant shark. It's head lice who developed a high level of resistance to some of the most popular treatments. Mutations, or mutant head lice, are giving the pest protection against permethrin, which hopefully I pronounced correctly, the active ingredient in many over-the-counter remedies. American scientists have found that lice, often the scourge of schools in Britain, have developed resistance in at least 25 American states, which, let's face it, is effectively half the country. Dr. Kyung Yoon of Southern Illinois University said what we find was that 104 out of the 109 lice populations we tested had high levels of gene mutations, which have been linked to resistance. D. Wright is owner of the Hare Force, Lice Assassins. And let's let D. explain what it does. Good morning. What is that all about in a brief advert?
Good morning, Nick. We are a net and head lice clearing service, and you won't be a product.
And so do you don't actually attend the child. You sell the kit or the ingredients that you need to make it happen.
No, we do all the clearing for a parent or a carer. We clear it all out.
Wow. You go to the home and wash the child's hair or whatever you have to do.
No, we don't use any product. The point is we are product free. So people come to us and we go to them. So we are a mobile service and we have Hair Force lounges in different parts of the country and people come to us.
That's very clever. I once heard, and you'll know, Dee, whether this is an old wives' tale, that actually it's not dirty hair that produces lice, it's clean hair that produces lice. How true is that?
It's not about clean or dirty hair, it's about blood. They're interested in feeding off your child's blood. So they like high blood sugar levels, so which is why they like young children more than anything. They like female adult, because females have higher blood sugar levels than males.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
And they're less keen on men. You're going to love this, because they dislike testosterone.
There we are. That's why I've never had them all my life. At the age of 9.
But it doesn't mean men are immune. If you've got, you know, a really good head of hair and
that's me.
You are very close to your children and your children have got a lot of lice, then you can get them. They're just not going to really like being on your hair, and they'll probably
When is a young girl, but I hear young boys as well, when are children most at risk? When is it most prevalent in their age, would you say, Dee?
Well, the old way of looking at head lice and researching head lice was always the 4 to 11-year-old age group.
Okay.
But because the products do not work, and we see a lot of evidence of that, because they don't work, and people are using them all the time, and partly because they are directed to use them. So if you get a letter home from school, it says use the products. If you look at the NHS website, it says use the products. Because people are using those products and they're not working, children move on from junior school or primary school to secondary school, and they take the lice with them. And we see an awful lot of older children with them. And we see a lot of children 14 to 17 with, you know, those...
All right. We've come to the latest development in this intriguing world, mutant head lice. How do you respond to that?
Well, we see... people with, when you say mutant, you always think massive, big head lice. And we see some, very resistant head lice. We see lots of children with a lot of head lice, and their parents are using a lot of product. So the lice are pretty much immune to what, what parents are putting on their hair.
Right. So the chemicals then, what do you do instead if it's not using chemicals? How do you do it?
Yeah, so we use a clever combination of hand clearing and clever technology. So we are hoovering the hair with a very specialist lice hoover to extract all of the crawling head lice. And we catch them in a filter so we can look at them, we can examine what we're extracting and understand the level of the infestation we're dealing with.
What's the worst you've ever dealt with?
We have, for example, a few weeks ago, we were clearing a girl whose mother, when she booked her in, said, I don't think her infestation is that heavy. Mm. She was a 16-year-old.
Mm.
When we hoovered her, on her head, in excess of 3,000 head lice.
Oh, my. And what would be a typical infestation, just so that I get a sense of what that means? How many would normally be?
Yeah, I mean, we see a fair number of people who are in the very heavy.
So we're extracting in the thousands for head lice. Oh. An average infestation, you might see a couple of hundred eggs and, you know, 25 to 30 lice.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And last...
Typically...
I was going to ask this drug, this chemical, pyrethroids. What are they meant to do?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I've mispronounced it. What are they meant to do?
They're meant to... They kill the nervous system of the head lice. But they don't work, and they've been shown not to work for a very long time. I mean, there was a massive study working with all of the health authorities in Wales back in 2006, and they were pretty disgraced at that point in 2006. What is really interesting, Nick, this is one of the very... I can't think of any other consumer market where people will buy something they know doesn't work. They know because your radio station has covered this before. Many newspapers and magazine articles say these products don't work. Parents have their own empirical evidence. They have their own evidence that it doesn't work because they use them time and time again, and they'll look the next day and they'll find lice.
All right.
And so they think, right, I better use it again.
We're fresh out of time. Just lastly, for Hair Force lice assassins, how much is a treatment, just broadly speaking, so my listeners get an idea?
Yeah. We see somebody twice, 7 days apart, and we see them twice, importantly.
Yeah, no, how much? I'm out of time.
£100 for the first visit, £50 for the second, outside London, £80 for the first visit.
Hair Force, Lice Assassins, D. Wright, thank you, you're the owner. I'm Nick Ferrari, you've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.